Hello, and welcome to the Learning to Slay the Beast podcast, a resilience podcast where we talk about all the challenging things that we're working to overcome, like anxiety, health, and relationship issues. My name is Sarah. Welcome to another episode of the Learning to Slay the Beast podcast. I'm really happy to connect with you this week. We are going to be speaking with a sleep professional, an insomnia specialist and psychotherapist. Her name is Savannah Hypes. She is going to really help us to understand more about sleep, more about insomnia, and why it's happening. She helps highly driven, sleep-deprived professionals who feel exhausted and sometimes on edge, and they finally get to sleep through the night. So Savannah is based in Orlando, Florida, and she's licensed in Florida and then also New York. And so this episode is really how to finally get that good sleep that you're looking for. We find out what impacts our sleep, what we can do to make changes. And I really want to say the driver for this one wasn't so much my own sleep. That's been going pretty well, but I've definitely had years of sleep issues. But it was more for my mom. I was speaking with her. She told me she had sleep issues. I tried to give her some advice. My sister tried to give her some advice. And then I thought, why don't I bring on somebody that's going to be an insomnia specialist who can put together an episode, because I'm sure my mom is not the only one struggling with this issue. So please join me and please welcome to this episode, Savannah Hypes. So welcome, Savannah, to the podcast. I'm happy to connect with you today.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Perfect. So why don't we start with you providing a little bit about your background?
Yes, my background. So I am a licensed clinical social worker in the state of Florida and New York. I have my background in psychology. My undergrad is in psychology, and then my master's is in social work. And I really got connected to the topic of sleep while I was doing a fellowship program with the Gulf Coast Veterans Healthcare System in Pensacola, Florida. So I was there at the VA, and I did this year-long program where I received a lot of training and supervision and education in specific treatments for veterans. So there were treatments for trauma that I learned, cognitive processing therapy, behavioral sleep medicine was a big thing that I did a rotation in, where I learned cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, as well as acceptance and commitment therapy for insomnia. So there's a lot of really amazing information that I learned there at the VA. And that's really where my background is working with sleep, with veterans and people who have had military service. And then I also did a couple of years working at an eating disorder treatment center. So those are kind of my two specific, you know, populations that I have worked with and where I've gotten the most of my training from. They actually overlap quite a bit. There are a lot of veterans who experience both insomnia and eating disorders, and of course, anxiety and trauma. They all really fit together. So now I am in private practice here in Central Florida. My in-person office is in Winter Park, and then I see people virtually throughout the state of Florida, as well as New York.
Wow, super interesting. And so I guess, you know, a lot can impact our sleep. Like you mentioned a few specific populations there, but what kind of things, and maybe it's the better question is what doesn't impact our sleep, but maybe you can get into what kind of things do impact our sleep and how we can start to end up with these issues.
Yes, absolutely. There are real, like you said, it's really what doesn't impact our sleep. And I like to tell people, you know, the things that impact your sleep are actually more about what you do during the day than it is how you behave at night. A lot of people think it's just a nighttime problem, insomnia, but really it's an entire life kind of scheduling problem. There's so many things that go into it, but it might be helpful for me to share a little bit about how sleep works, because that's mostly what people don't know about. They know that they wake up in the middle of the night and it feels like alarm bells are going off in their head. They're like suddenly wide awake, tired but wired. They might know that they lay in bed tossing and turning for hours and hours and they're so miserable and their body is tense and they just hate the experience. Those are the things that they know. But what they don't know is how sleep actually is designed to work on its own, and it works magnificently. So there's a few things that really regulate our sleep. These are biological functions. The first one is called a sleep drive. So this is similar to our drive for eating, our drive for seeking out water. This is a really natural biological drive. And it tells us that our body needs sleep. It is a requirement. It's not just something that we like or find useful. It's actually something that's required for us to live. So our drive for sleep typically grows throughout the day. It's actually a chemical pressure that builds up on our brain. The longer that we've been awake, the drive gets higher and higher. Similar to eating, you know, if you haven't eaten all day long, your hunger grows and grows, your drive for food gets stronger. So that's one of the main things that regulates our sleep is that drive. It will grow throughout the day. And then when we do give it sleep, that drive goes down. So a few things that people don't realize get in the way of their sleep is when they are decreasing their drive, in ways they don't intend. Like, for example, if you take a nap in the middle of the day, that might be similar to having a really big ice cream sundae at 5 p.m. when you're scheduled to eat dinner at 6 o'clock. If you eat that big sundae, by the time dinner comes around, you're really not going to be very hungry for it. But then suddenly at midnight, you're starving because you didn't eat dinner because you weren't hungry at dinner time. The same thing happens with our sleep. If we take a big nap in the middle of the day, or if we spend too much time in a really kind of relaxed state where we're not moving, we're not very active, our brain kind of interprets that as we're getting some rest. And so our drive decreases. And then by the time we get to the end of the day, when we should be nice and tired and ready to go to sleep, our drive is actually lower than it needs to be, and we have a hard time falling asleep. So that's one thing that really regulates our sleep. The next thing I will talk about is the circadian rhythm, but I do want to pause first. I'm curious how that hits you, hearing about our sleep drive.
I think that makes so much sense. And I mean, I really like that analogy to kind of like eating before your meal, right? Like that's great. And it's easy to understand. I will use that with my kids. Because my teen is constantly battling me about, I don't need the sleep. I can stay up late and all of this stuff. So yeah, really good.
Yeah. And our sleep changes a lot depending on the stage of life we're in. Like the sleep that an adolescent needs, both the amount and the timing is vastly different than someone who's in their middle age or older age. It really changes significantly. But something also that people don't realize helps regulate sleep is light intake. And that's because of our circadian rhythm. Circadian rhythm just basically means your body's clock. Your body knows what time it is based on certain indicators like light intake. So when you get up in the morning and your eyes take in some natural light, it shoots to your brain a message that says, it's morning, it's daytime. And then your brain sends out an alerting signal to the rest of the body that says, be awake, be alert, it's daytime. So all of those messages are being given throughout your body. And that's really what helps you to stay alert during the day, is that your brain knows what time it is. And then throughout the day, you do your typical routine. Maybe you eat breakfast, you go to work, you do your next thing. And all of those repetitive behaviors really communicate to your brain, we're on track, we're moving through the day, it's been an hour. Like, it really tells your body what time it is. And then you get to the evening and you start to not have a whole lot of daylight. So it's been a couple of hours since you've had any natural daylight come into your eyes. It's getting dark out, you're inside, the lights are dim, and your brain says, oh, it's been a while since we've had light. It must be evening, it must be nighttime. And it says, we don't need to be alert anymore. And it stops sending out that alerting signal. So you start to get tired, you start to get drowsy because your brain has told you it's okay to get sleepy now. We don't need to be alert anymore. So your brain knows what time it is based on those indicators of daylight, as well as social engagement and routine behaviors. You might imagine how difficult it would be for someone who's not experiencing a lot of light intake throughout the day Maybe people who are older and their eyes have actually deteriorated a bit, so they don't sense that light as well as other people do. Or maybe people who are inside most of the day, who don't have a lot of windows in their home, people who work from home, they don't get a lot of breaks to go outside. In all those circumstances, you kind of get confused. Your body is not quite sure what time of day it is. And so it doesn't know when to tell you to be alert versus when to tell you to be sleepy. The same thing happens if you have really different schedules throughout the week. Like if you sleep in on the weekend, your brain is like, wait a minute, we've been noticing some light for a while, but we haven't eaten breakfast yet. You know, if you eat breakfast at noon, your brain goes, is this our morning meal or is this a later meal? Does this mean it's 9 a.m.? What time is it? And it's not so sure. So it doesn't confidently tell you whether to be alert or sleepy. And that really can impact the way that you perceive your own energy levels. And you don't know when to get sleepy. Your body's not giving you those cues anymore. So those are some really important things to be aware of when we're thinking about how does sleep work and why am I feeling sleepy or why am I not?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can see the winter for sure would have an impact on, you know, that amount of light. Like I know we get a lot of gray days. And then like, you know, people in the north who have like an even more or less light, I guess, like a more restricted light day. So yeah, that I'm sure there's lots of those impacts for sure. And so if we're starting to notice a situation where we're just not getting the quality of sleep we want, or maybe it's been something that's been going on a long time, what are some of the things that you start with to help impact, I guess it would be the drive and then the circadian rhythm?
What I do is first teach them how those things work, because there's a lot of stuff that we do on a regular basis that we don't realize is impacting our sleep, like taking naps during the day, like getting out of bed at a totally different time each day and confusing our body clock, like not getting a lot of daylight, not prioritizing spending time during the day outside or next to an open window. So I really do a lot of education to start with. But I also ask people to be really aware of their own experience. Like, what do they notice tends to get in the way of their sleep? For a lot of people, they'll say that they have a lot of trouble with falling asleep because they're laying in bed. And as soon as they go to relax in bed, they feel really awake and like plagued by lots of thoughts, whether it's thoughts about the day, whether they're worrying and they're really like having a lot of concern and anxiety, or if it's just random stuff that's just kind of popping into their mind. It really gets frustrating for them to be laying there and just suddenly having all of these thoughts that they don't know what to do with. And they're thinking, come on, I just finally got a break. I finally get to rest. And now I'm being plagued. So for those people, I really like to talk to them about what happens when we spend time in our bed doing something that's not sleeping. This is something that's called conditioned insomnia. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Pavlov's dog research study. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
So I'll explain it a little bit for your listeners. There was also an Office episode. Are you an Office fan?
Yes, yes.
So maybe you know what I'm thinking of. In the Office, their Jim is training Dwight to be conditioned to want a Mint or an Altoid at the sound of his computer restarting. In the research study originally, A Russian researcher taught his dogs to salivate at the sound of a bell. And how he did that is he had dogs, he would feed his dog, and as soon as the dog smelled the food or saw the food, it would start salivating, and he would ring a bell. As soon as he saw that salivation, he would ring a bell. So the dog's brain started to pair those two things, the salivation, the eating experience with the bell. And then eventually, he would not give the dog any food, but if the dog salivated, he would still ring a bell. And then over time, he would ring a bell and the dog would start salivating at the anticipation of food, even without any food being provided. So basically what this means is our brain creates a paired connection between two separate things. And for many people experiencing insomnia, their brain creates a connection between their bed or their bedroom and the experience of hyperarousal, whether that's cognitive arousal, lots of thoughts, lots of emotions, or physiological arousal, the experience of being tense and being very awake and maybe being excited. So if you're spending time in bed having all of your thoughts, worrying about the next day, checking off your to-do list, if you're spending time in bed watching a really fun, exciting movie or reading your favorite murder mystery novel or studying for a project that you have due coming up or a presentation at work, if you're doing those tasks in your bed, your brain has created an association. It says, oh, here's my bed. This is the place where I do all of my great planning and thinking. Instead of seeing your bed when you go in there to go to bed for the night, your brain should be going, oh yeah, this is my bed. This is the place where I feel relaxed and this is the place where I sleep. So we've taught it a new thing when we spend time in our bed doing something other than sleeping. And so what I have people do actually when this is what they're experiencing is if they are in their bed and they haven't fallen asleep within 15 or 20 minutes, I actually have them get up and go to a different room and wait until they are sleepy again. Because I don't want that association happening in your brain. I don't want more proof for your brain that the bedroom is where you go to be awake. I only want evidence to your brain that the bed is the place we go to be asleep. So I have them get up, which is really challenging for a lot of people, but also is so effective at retraining that conditioned response.
That's so interesting. Okay. And I have heard that before, like people saying like, don't lay in your bed and like toss and turn, like kind of start over. But yeah, that I think understanding the why makes a big difference, that you're creating an association there. And so that's why that's not a good idea. And yeah, I mean, I have times where sometimes the day is so busy and by the time I get to bed, I lay down and I think, oh my gosh, I think this is the first time that I've rested. Like, oh, it's time for bed. And like, I almost do have that few minutes where it's like, my brain's like, oh, everything's quiet, you know, like just that, that moment. And so I wonder if I should be doing that outside of the bedroom, or do we only make those changes if we have a problem sleeping? Like I generally do sleep well.
Ooh, great question. Oh my gosh. I'm so glad that just after hearing some very basic education about sleep, you're automatically thinking, wait a minute, should I be doing my reflection on the day? Should I be doing that in a different place than my bed?
Yeah.
See how quick this is, that as soon as you understand what's happening, you automatically know what you need to change. That's actually a treatment also that I do with people who are struggling with lots of thoughts coming to their mind at night, whether they're worrisome thoughts or they're just like, let me reflect on the day. Let me process a little bit. I finally have a moment to myself in my mind. I actually have them schedule time to do that earlier in the day in a different room, or you're just outside of their bed. Like sit down for 20 minutes, whether it's after dinner or before dinner, but not right as you're going to bed. Schedule that time to make a list of everything that's been worrying you recently, or just be quiet for a few minutes and invite any of your mind's thoughts to come. Just say, what am I feeling right now? What am I noticing? What's been on my mind today? Let me get quiet for a second and let all of those things bombard me so that I can give them the time of day and the space in my mind and reflect on them now so that it doesn't do that as soon as I lay down into bed. That's called designated worry time. Anyways, your question was, do we make these changes if I'm having a problem, or is this how I maintain healthy sleep? And that's a fantastic one. And I like to describe two different things by relating it to brushing your teeth. So if you brush your teeth regularly, you will most likely have healthy gums and you won't need any kind of specific treatment. Unless you get like an infection or something or gingivitis, then you need a specific treatment. If you have gingivitis and you think, oh, I'll just keep brushing my teeth. That's great, but it's not going to fix the gingivitis. You need to go get like a treatment. You need to see your dentist. I don't know actually what the treatment for gingivitis is, but it's not brushing your teeth. Versus if your sleep is, if your teeth are healthy, you just keep brushing and that keeps them healthy. So how this equates to sleep is sleep hygiene. I don't know if you've heard this term, sleep hygiene. Mm-hmm. These are the basic, most foundational things for healthy sleep that your doctor will typically tell you. If you say, I'm having trouble sleeping, what do? They will say, get up at the same time every day. Don't eat a heavy meal within 2 hours of going to bed. Decrease your alcohol intake. Exercise in the morning. They'll tell you all these extremely basic things. Sleep in a quiet place that's dark and cool, like bare minimum. Those are the things I recommend when people are sleeping well and they want to continue promoting good, healthy sleep. You know that you have a problem if you're laying in bed and tossing and turning for 30 minutes to an hour every night. You know that you have a problem if you're waking up multiple times at night and are awake for a long time. It's really normal to wake up a few times during the night. In fact, every single person does it. That's just how the brain works. It likes to wake up and do like a quick check to make sure our environment is still safe and we can keep sleeping. But if you're awake for more than a few minutes during that awakening and you don't fall back asleep pretty quickly, and that's happening really frequently throughout the night and you're waking up really tired because you've been waking up so frequently, that's a problem. So when you have some of those actual problems to your sleep and it's starting to freak you out, you're starting to think, oh my gosh, I'm really nervous about this. I'm afraid of the health consequences that are going to come from this. I start to feel worried when it even gets dark out because I'm like, oh, tonight's going to be such a drag. I wonder how long it's going to take me to fall asleep. As soon as you're starting to have those thoughts come into your mind, as soon as it's causing consequences for your day, like you feel like it's getting in the way of you doing things you enjoy or performing at work or other things like that, that's when it's time for a treatment. It's no longer time for the basic brushing your teeth, the basic, you know, getting up at the same time every day and then making sure your bed is cold at night. That's really the difference there. You asked, like, when should I be doing mm-hmm. these specific things versus not? And it's when you feel like it's developing into a problem and you're starting to get concerned about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, it's maybe something that we can do like a little check-in on our sleep every now mm-hmm. and again, or something like that. And that's how we would be able to know when we need to make changes. I know that you did a project with tech workers. I wondered if you wanted to kind of explain what that was and what your findings, so we could learn a little bit more.
I would love to. I am really excited about this, actually, because as we know, many people have trouble sleeping. This is like across the board, humans in general have the possibility of struggling to sleep. And there's a lot of different things that go into why certain people are more at risk than others. But I think that there are certain people in certain situations that really have a higher vulnerability to having trouble sleeping. And I was curious about, are there certain work environments, are there certain types of jobs that would lead to a difficulty with sleeping? And why would that be? We know that people who work like shift work, like doctors and nurses, flight attendants, there's a lot of different reasons why you would have a shift work job. And those for sure cause trouble with your sleeping, primarily because of the circadian rhythm that we talked about. Your body is getting indicators about what time of day it is. And those indicators are like wrong. They're eating and behaving and sleeping mm-hmm. at the wrong times. And so your body clock and the outside world clock gets misaligned. But outside of that, what are the other jobs where you might have, you might expect to find some trouble sleeping? And I just had like a thought that people working in the tech industry might be one of those vulnerable job positions. There's been a lot of talk in the last few years about AI, and are all of our tech workers going to suddenly lose their jobs because AI knows how to do it better than them? And there's so much fear around that. So that really brought it to my mind. So what I did is I started looking for people to interview who work in the tech industry of some sort, whether they are a software developer, a UX designer, whether they're just an IT manager. I wanted to get like a really diverse experience from people who work in this industry and who do say that they struggle to sleep. And so I interviewed lots of people and I wrote a series on what I found in those interviews on my website called Insomnia in the Tech Industry. And what I found is that there's a lot of cultural factors that would lead people to have trouble sleeping who work in tech. There's a lot of certain personality characteristics that go into tech work. People who are really complex thinkers, who are really detail-oriented, people who are programmers, who are writing code and doing all of that complex techie stuff that most of us couldn't even try and imagine what it's like. Those people who do really complex thinking and strategizing and detail-oriented work, they have brains that I've heard called tinker brains. They like to tinker with things. They like to figure out problems. There's plenty of other professions that also attract people with a tinker brain. I can't even give lots of examples because there's really a lot. But in terms of tech in particular, people are attracted to tech work who like to tinker, who like to solve problems, like engineers who like to do trial and error over and over and over until they can get the exact right piece of code in their program. And those kinds of brains are going to stay up all night to figure out the problem because it's exciting to them. And it feels so gratifying when they finally get it right. And they have trouble sleeping because of that. So that's one factor that I found that in the tech industry, people have trouble sleeping because of. There are other things too, like people who do tech work tend to spend a lot of time really isolated and indoors. Their work is primarily at their computer, which I know many of us are work from homers now. Many of us have primarily computer-based jobs. But I think it's a little bit different where some jobs are you use the computer adjunctly throughout the day versus your primary role is figuring something out on the computer. Mm-hmm. And just the personality factors, I think, that attract tech work is very isolated, like people who just tend to like things solo, introverted. They like to do one thing for a long period of time and get it right. And so that means that they're not going to be super active getting up to talk with people throughout the day, especially if they work from home, which a lot of tech jobs are work from home now. They're not going to be getting a whole lot of daylight throughout the day if they don't really have a reason to go outside, if they don't make that a priority. So those things really mean that someone is going to be working for long hours, staring at the computer without natural daylight coming in and without kind of a social schedule. The scheduling part is important there too. Kind of like your circadian rhythm likes things to be on a schedule. It likes to know that you're eating breakfast at this time every day so that it can tell you it's morning time. People in tech work tend to have really flexible schedules. They could work all night and they do frequently. There's a culture of people, especially like in the gaming world, who prefer to be social late at night online, or they prefer to do a lot of their work late at night. And because of that, their brain is going to get confused about what time of day it is. So all those things together really were just indicators that I didn't know about until I did this project where I interviewed all these people, that people who work in tech have a really high vulnerability to not sleeping well. And that's going to lead them to have a lot of dissatisfaction at their job, to be really exhausted, and to judge themselves for their experience as well. That's another thing that I noticed just throughout my interviews, that people were saying, yeah, I've got some trouble sleeping, but it's my own fault. It's because I didn't do blank, 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 rather than it's something that I can get help for. And that is not automatically my fault, but is a factor of the environment and the industry that I work in. So that's been really fun for me, just to kind of delve into a specific set of people in a specific kind of workplace and figure out what are the factors for them that are impacting their ability to sleep.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I don't think you hear that so much in shift workers where they sort of blame themselves. Like it's sort of more like, oh no, well it's kind of because of the timing and where they're, yeah, they're sort of saying, oh, it's my own issue. So that's interesting.
Something you said about that, like shift workers don't blame themselves. There's a morality factor that comes in with sleep too. Many people I spoke to said, well, it's expected that, a good hard worker gets up in the morning and does their job versus a person who is lazy sleeps in. And those are not true things, but it's a belief that a lot of our workforce has at the moment and really gets in the way of one, us being able to get good sleep, because when we're worrying about our goodness versus our badness and our morality, that's going to keep us awake. But also, it prevents us from getting help, because if we think, oh, I'm just a bad person and that's why I can't sleep well, you're not going to go ask someone like a therapist to help you get better sleep. So really, bringing up for people and normalizing that this is not a you problem. This is an industry problem. This is a US problem to an extent when we compare different cultures, especially. So, and this is something that you actually can change. You can sleep better. It's possible.
Okay, no, that's really interesting. And I was thinking more that maybe some of the challenges come from them looking at the screens and like the artificial light from the screen. Is that at all, did that at all come up?
So I'm really glad you're bringing that up because it's a huge myth to bust.
Interesting.
There's been a lot of research the last few years, specifically around the use of technology and sleep. And all the messaging that we got, originally, let's say 20 years ago, when tech was becoming such a big thing, we started having our own devices in our homes, individual technological devices in our hands. There was a lot of fear around that. And we thought, okay, is this impacting our sleep? And the recommendations were to limit your use of screen time because it's going to disrupt your sleep or your circadian rhythm because of the light intake. Which makes sense on a general note, but when we've actually looked at the research the past 10 years, and a lot of studies have been done, it really debunks that the use of technology for some can really help them to fall asleep. For some, it may cause a disruption, but it's not necessarily the technology that is the problem. We really haven't seen a big change in like the light exposure. We do recommend people to dim their lights in the evening. So if you've got a computer screen you're working on, maybe dim it a little bit, or there are red light, blue light glasses you can use to kind of change the tone of the light. But overall, what we're seeing is that actually what changes your ability to sleep relating to technology is how engaged you are in the activity. So if you're playing a video game that is really exciting, and most video games are psychologically developed to increase in difficulty at only like just the right pace that will keep you engaged and having like a certain level of success, but also a certain level of challenge. There's like a sweet spot there that really causes people to want to continue to engage and to go to the next level. But doesn't defeat them so much that they're like, ah, I'm done with this for tonight. Same thing with reading a book. Like, books are not a good book. It's not typically extremely boring and then extremely exciting. It's got tidbits of excitement and kind of slower pace mixed throughout that keeps you engaged. Television, commercials, like all of this is designed to keep the consumer engaged. So, whatever activity you're doing, whether it's on a screen or not, is really more about your level of engagement and arousal. And if you're experiencing a lot of heightened arousal, whether that's because you're excited or you're scared, you're watching a horror film, whether it's because you're in the middle of solving a problem, and you're on your computer and you're solving a work problem, if you're really engaged in it, that's going to keep you physiologically and cognitively aroused, and that causes a problem with your sleep. So it's really not the actual technology, it's your level of engagement and arousal, which is why I recommend for people to spend somewhere around an hour doing really relaxing activities in the evening that don't cause a whole lot of arousal or a whole lot of engagement, but are really restful. And that could use technology. It could be a boring TV show. It could be National Geographic. It could be hearing Morgan Freeman describe an animal, you know, whatever, something very chill that doesn't excite you and is kind of boring. It also could be reading something, but not reading like an exciting thriller novel, reading like something that's boring. So it might be reading the dictionary or, you know, doing a Sudoku.
Your textbook.
Exactly.
Used to work for me in university.
Oh, you actually use that to fall asleep?
Sometimes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Maybe unintentionally. Maybe you were actually trying to study and it didn't work. Yeah. Call that myth busted. You know, don't ream out your kids for using their tech at night, because research shows it's really difficult to get your kid to separate from their technology at night. Mm-hmm. It's more really about how they're feeling, relaxing their body, helping them do something that is kind of relieving and soothing, but not extremely activating or engaging in the evening. And that may be via their technology or it may not be.
Okay. So kind of getting, so for example, with the video games, like cutting that off like an hour before bed or something like that, and then maybe moving to something a little more relaxing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it could still be, you know, it could still be something that's on, that's using technology. That's not really the problem. It's more if they know that they're so excited that they will want to play this for as long as they can keep their eyes open. That's more the problem than the actual screen.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I think that's really helpful. Now let's talk about another issue that comes up with sleep, snoring. So I guess, do you know sort of a little more about it, the cause? And then I know if you snore or your partner snores, it can be super disruptive. So wondered if you had any kind of background and advice around dealing with snoring.
Yes. So snoring actually goes really hand in hand with sleep apnea, which is something that I will say I'm not an expert in. There's actually many different sleep disorders. Insomnia is one, and that's what I specialize in, insomnia and nightmares. There are many other sleep disorders. Sleep apnea is one. You know, there's other things like sleepwalking. There's really a lot I could go into, but I do want to give a little bit of information about snoring and sleep apnea because it's so common. Actually, about 20% of the population experience sleep apnea, but most of those go undiagnosed. Most people that don't realize that they have it. And it's important to notice if you are experiencing obstructive sleep apnea, because it can cause a lot of other health and mental health conditions like hypertension, heart disease. It can cause mood and memory problems, as well as excessive daytime sleepiness or drowsiness during the day, which actually I've heard countless stories of, you know, near fatal car accidents that were caused by obstructive sleep apnea. So let me just say what that is and how snoring plays in. Obstructive sleep apnea is a condition where your airway is obstructed while you're trying to sleep. It's often obstructed by like your tongue or your adenoids, something physically in your kind of throat area. And it causes you to either completely stop breathing during the night or to just have much more limited breathing. So you might notice that you are snoring. That's an example of an indication that you might be not getting all the oxygen that you need at night. You might also stop breathing completely and your partner might hear you like completely stop breathing or witness that happen for you. And then suddenly kind of like jerk awake or go, kind of take a crazy breath after that. Those are examples of what it might look like if you have obstructive sleep apnea. And it's important to go get a sleep study if you think that's happening for you, because of all those other things it can lead to. Most people don't are not aware of it though. Like you might wake up once or twice at night, kind of like gasping a little bit, but it's really the partner who's going to observe that happen more frequently. And I would say if you're hearing your partner snore really, really loudly, not just a little bit of snoring, but really loudly, or if you've witnessed them stop breathing during the night, tell them that and have them go check in with their doctor about it. There's actually an acronym that you can use if you want to kind of check in with yourself or your partner about this. It's STOP, S-T-O-P. So the S stands for snoring. And that's not just light snoring. That's really loud snoring that you could hear like in the other room with the door closed. T stands for tiredness. So if you're really tired during the day, maybe even very drowsy or very fatigued. O is observe. So if you've been observed to stop breathing during your sleep. And then P stands for pressure. This is blood pressure. If you have high blood pressure, you're more likely to be experiencing obstructive sleep apnea. So if you said yes to two or more of any of those, anyone listening, go to your doctor, let them know, and talk about it. Snoring, I mention as part of that because obviously snoring is one of the signs, but there's also a lot of people who have sleep apnea who aren't snorers. You could be any gender, any age. There's also a lot of information about out there about like weight and how that could impact or increase your possibility of having sleep apnea. But really I would encourage people, if any of those sound like you in the STOP, that acronym, go get checked out. Even if you're, not overweight, even if you don't experience a lot of snoring, but you have those other things, just go get checked out, because really a lot of people are experiencing this. But there's a lot of other reasons for snoring too that are not sleep apnea. You could just be congested. If you have a lot of allergies, that sinus congestion could kind of partially get in the way of that airway. It's also something where you might have like the position of your body can lead to snoring. So if you're laying flat on your back, you're more likely to snore than if you are elevated a little bit, like if your head and shoulders are elevated, or if you sleep on your side. There's a lot of different reasons why you might snore that are really normal and that are not a problem. So it's not automatically an issue unless it's really loud and accompanied by those other things that we talked about.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. My husband recently started using this wedge that kind of like elevates him a bit. And yeah, we've noticed a difference. It wasn't for the snoring, but then all of a sudden I was like, you know, you're not snoring as much. It's kind of like a plus. Yeah. Yeah. So that makes sense when you say like just it can be the position even.
That's fantastic to hear. And a lot of people don't realize as well, things like using alcohol or taking sedatives, like a lot of the time for insomnia, you go to your doctor, they give you the basic sleep hygiene, and then oftentimes physicians don't have the availability or they don't know of providers in the area who do cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which is a lot of those things that we talked about earlier, like the reconditioning and all of that. So once they've done the basic sleep hygiene, they'll say, okay, well here, take this medication, have some Ambien. And that actually might also cause you to snore because it reduces the muscle tone, of the muscles in your throat. And so it can cause a little bit of like weakening of those muscles and collapsing of that airway.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So lots can impact and go hand in hand here. That's really interesting. So, I mean, as we're getting towards wrapping up, I think this has been so much great information and it helps to explain a lot about what's going on. Other tips or advice that you want to raise for listeners before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would really say to your listeners to notice your own experience and take yourself seriously. If you're having trouble sleeping, or if you're feeling really exhausted during the day and you're starting to worry about it, take that seriously, because insomnia affects so many people. Sleep apnea affects so many people. And it can affect so many other areas of your life. It starts to impact your relationships. You notice yourself feeling really cranky when you're talking to other people. You might start opting to not go to certain social engagements. And that really gets in the way of living the life that you want to live. If you're not enjoying time with your family anymore, because you're so tired and exhausted. And if you're not going out to the soccer game and doing these socially engaging activities because you're thinking, oh, I'm so tired, I just need a rest. If you're going to bed excessively early because you're feeling so tired and you missed out on, you know, movie night with the kids, that's really going to get in the way of your quality of life. And there are specific things that we can do that are really quick, honestly, and effective. That's why I always like to tell people about cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. It's just not talked about enough. Oftentimes doctors, it's not really their go-to to recommend, even though it's more effective than sleeping medications in the long term, as well as oftentimes in the short term. And it really can improve so many areas of your life. So that's what I would encourage, is just people to check in with themselves and notice if there's a problem that you're having. Don't brush it off. Don't wait to deal with it till next year. Because you can go a long time feeling really tired and not realize how much joy that's sucking from your life, honestly.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And I think one of the things that can be challenging too with sleep is like some nights you'll be fine and then another mm-hmm. night you're not, and then another night you're fine. And so it's like, it's hard to track it down and it becomes like a frustration for sure.
Yes, your sleep is gaslighting you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You don't know what it's trying to tell you.
As soon as you notice that frustration that's happening frequently, you know, that's the third part of sleep that I didn't really talk about is arousal. We did a little bit briefly speak about arousal, but arousal is like the emergency brakes on your sleep. If everything else is working well, if your circadian rhythm is appropriately aligned, your body knows what time it is, if your sleep drive is nice and high and those are going great, you will sleep well. Unless your arousal is too high. And by that, I mean, your body is tense. Your mind is racing. You're laying in bed and you're feeling the frustration in your body about not having fallen asleep yet. It's an emergency break. It's built in to keep us safe so that if we're not in a safe environment, our body won't let us sleep. Except now we internalize cognitions and worries as unsafe. And so our body keeps us awake. I would say as soon as you have that frustration and it's recurring, that's when it's time to get some help.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And so how can listeners find out more about you if they want to connect with you? Is it best online or through social media?
I would encourage you to check out my website, which is www.savannahypeslcsw.com. My last name is spelled H like Henry, I like ice cream, P like Peter, E like Edward, S like Savannah. You'll find a way to contact me via the phone, via email. You can check out, you can read through the article series that I wrote on insomnia in the tech industry, mm-hmm. And check out my other podcast appearances. Or you can just give me a call directly and say, hey, I'm curious about this. Tell me a little bit of your story and I can help you tease out if some treatment for insomnia would be right for you. So my phone number is on my website. You can go find it there.
Okay.
Give me a call. And anyone who references this podcast, I would love to give 50% off to your first session because I know it's hard to find resources for sleep. And I really want to make sure that people are getting the support that they need. So if you're a listener and you call me and you want to start some treatment, it's usually only 6 to 8 weeks of therapy to get the mm-hmm. sleep changes that you're looking for. And if you let me know that you listened to Learning to Slay the Beast podcast, I'll just give 50% off that first session.
Oh, that's amazing. That's a really nice gift. And that's very quick. Like you're right. 6 to 8 weeks. Wow. That's amazing to see results.
It is. Behavioral treatment is quick, man. Once we recondition that brain of yours, you'll be good.
Okay, that's awesome. Well, this has been so wonderful. I've learned a lot, and I think listeners probably have too. So I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much to Savannah Hypes for joining me on the Learning to Slay the Beast podcast this week. I think this was an excellent episode, kind of gave us everything on sleep and insomnia. I loved that she is willing to give 50% off to those who want to investigate their sleep further and do a first session with her if you reference the Learning to Slay the Beast podcast. Also, please check out her website, SavannahHypesLCSW.com, for all of her information and being able to connect with her. Also, I know she's on Instagram at SavannahHypesLCSW. Thanks so much to Savannah. I hope this was helpful to everybody that was interested to learn more about sleep and insomnia. Have a great week. Thank you for listening to the Learning to Slay the Beast podcast. Please keep in mind, this podcast is not intended to be medical or professional advice. If you'd like to hear more from me, you can follow me on social media, Instagram and TikTok at Sarah Lady Gluten, or Facebook, Sarah_Gluten Free Lady. You can also visit my website, which includes author information, speaking information, and more info on the podcast at www.se-german.com. If you like the podcast, please feel free to review the podcast on your favorite platform and also subscribe, because it means that it will show up for you every week on your favorite podcast platform. Also, we've just started to have the ability to support the podcast. You can find this link in my Instagram bio or visit ko-fi.com/learningtoslaythebeasts. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.